You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivastava Prakash.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today, we've got my friend Jeffrey Snyder on the show again. Jeff, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You need no introduction at this point. You've been on the podcast like three times now or four times. Thank you so much for being on again. You know, it's awesome to have you.
Hey, I'm always glad to be here. Always glad to see you, Sri, and looking forward to talking to you from the snow-capped mountains of Canada.
Absolutely, yes. And you know, it's probably a lot nicer down there in Florida. So
this time of year, yeah, but give it a few months and I'll gladly switch places with you.
Yes, sir. Okay, so Jeff, the one thing that's on everyone's minds, inflation. And so, you know, when it comes to a situation like what we're seeing right now, so you're seeing higher food and energy prices driven by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. You know, one, how much power does the Federal Reserve actually have at the moment, regardless of whether they hike or cut in order to, you know, pull inflation lower? And two, is the inflation, you know, are you still in the transitory camp of inflation? You know, what would have to change for you to switch camps?
Well, the first part first, I don't think the Fed has any ability to affect the what's going on in consumer prices or the economy whatsoever. And so, you know, not only is their standard non-money monetary policy pure theater, in this case, it's doubly or triply so because it's basically all politics at this point. And you can understand why. I mean, because, you know, the Biden administration, Democrats in Congress, the voting public is hopping mad about everything. The cost of living has gone way up and they're looking for somebody to blame. And by and large, they're also looking for somebody to offer some kind of solution, or at least as politicians always do, looking for somebody to appear to be doing something about consumer prices. And of course, who better to do the appearance of doing something than the Federal Reserve? And so the Fed is about to hike rates. It's usually theater anyway. This is double theater because they're trying to placate politicians who are trying to placate an angry public. Now, have I changed my view on consumer prices? The fact that I won't call it inflation should give you a clue, because I think, you know, this is still a classic supply shock case. And, you know, I was just going over the GDP numbers for the fourth quarter, the final estimates that the BA just put out. And you can see right down to the, you know, to the screws that this is a supply shock issue, not a money issue. And so if that's the case, then the supply shock will eventually work itself out. The problem is the way supply shocks work itself out is usually a downturn or recession. So we have demand destruction resulting from consumer prices being squeezed too high. And really, in a nutshell, that's what's going on in the bond market as we speak. The reason why the curves are so inverted is that bonds are saying, we told you, transitory consumer price, supply shock, recession risk, all demand destruction, all of these things are happening as we speak. And I think the problem is, and it's understandable too, when you say transitory consumer price pressures, here we are a year later, and most people are thinking, isn't transitory a couple days, maybe a couple weeks? Why is it, you know, March of 2022, we're still talking about this? But in macroeconomic terms, transitory can be a year. It can be longer than a year. You go back in time to say 1947, 48, there was a two-year period where a supply shock was much, much worse than anything we have now. So, you know, as long as there isn't the money behind it, it's not actually inflation. So over time, it's going to work out as temporary, even if temporary lasts a little bit longer than people would like.
Yeah. And so, you know, one topic that you mentioned was the yield curve. And so, you know, one, you know, is there a yield curve that's the right yield curve to watch, or do you just watch all of them? And, you know, what are yield curves telling you right now? You know, how are you interpreting what they're saying?
Yeah, there is no right yield curve. And there's really no, you know, there's no right way the yield. I mean, there's no, you know, it's not like you have a starting point and then everything, you know, any changes off it, we can easily quantify and map from. Really, it's what you have to look at the yield curve as a whole. You have to look at the yield curve and how it evolves through time from where it begins to where it is now, and take all of these different factors into account. But the public, you know, you're right. The public by and large believe, and they've been led to believe, that there's only one spot on the yield curve that actually matters, and that's the 2 year to 10 year. And so outside of that, and outside of the times when it's inverted, it's like we're not supposed to pay attention to the thing. You know, a lot of the Fed people who believe in the Fed and who believe in the mainstream economic narrative will tell you that we can't rely on the yield curve. We can't rely on the bond market because the Fed has bought so many bonds, and so they've muddied the waters. Yeah, but historically speaking, including over the last 15 years since quantitative easing has been introduced in the U.S., the yield curve changes and the changes in its shape have been very predictive and very useful tools for understanding the situation as it evolves. And so where we are today is, first we had euro dollar futures, which that curve flattened out going back to last October, same as time as the yield curve too. Then it inverted in December 1st of last year, which was an indication that market's starting to get a little antsy here, uncertain about whatever's going on. I think we just talked enough about it, supply shock, demand destruction, as well as a potential monetary deflationary money currency, collateral shortages, all sorts of technical problems too. So Eurodollar futures, they've been kind of warning that things have taken a wrong turn back in December. And ever since then, that inversion has expanded relatively quickly, shockingly quickly, and it has transited into the yield curve. And over the last month or so, parts of the yield curve inverted, starting with the 7-year point, which is not all that unusual, although the level it has attained is unusual. So like the Eurodollar futures curve, the yield curve inversion started far down at the far end, and it has moved up as we progressed in time to the point where, was it just yesterday, I believe, the yield for the 2-year actually did go above the yield for the 10-year during the day. It was around 12:30 in the afternoon. I was watching it pretty closely. I was actually talking to somebody in the media about this. And I watched, the two-year went above the 10-year. Didn't think it would close inverted, and it didn't. But the fact that it inverted at all kind of signals that, again, we can see this progression in uncertainty and pessimism and deflationary risk rising ever since last October, when things really took a serious turn in Eurodollar futures and everything else. And so it's been almost a straight line ever since then. So we got, 6 months here where you could see this thing coming a mile away.
Yeah. And, one thing that you mentioned was the possibility of a recession. And so, I guess the typical thing that most people understand is when the yield curve inverts, that sort of signals that within the next, say, 12 to 18 months, we're supposed to witness a recession. And
I'm going to push back on that, because I think that's a misnomer too. The idea that the yield curve inverts and then you've got a year and a half or a year at the most, that's not true. There are some cases when the long end of the yield curve inverts, and in a matter of mere months, the recession shows up. 1990, perfect example. Long end of the yield curve inverted in early 1990, and the NBER says recession July, and then Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in August, and then oil prices along the way. So it's not necessarily 12 to 18 months down the road. And I think we have to pay attention to the surprisingly quick way the yield curve has transited in the Eurodollar futures curve. I was expecting, like the 2018 case in Eurodollar futures, where it took about 6 months for the little tiniest of inversion to start to become more substantial. In 2022, it took 2.5 months. And now the Eurodollar futures curve is like 70 some basis points upside down. I mean, massive inversion in a matter of a couple months. The yield curve, it was relatively steep when it started back in October. And then ever since, just before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the yield curve has just collapsed. It just dropped into flat and then inverted in a very quick pace. And I think there might be some information in the how quickly this has developed, especially over more recent weeks, where maybe that 12 to 18 month time frame isn't applicable here.
I see. So, what would the Fed have to see, what do you think the Fed would have to see in order for them to change their path? So the Fed has sort of committed to raising rates, destroying demand, and obviously risking a recession in order to curtail inflation. So, what would the Fed actually have to see in order for them to, step away from that and potentially do the complete opposite of it, which is start to lower rates?
It's a great question, because I think that's exactly what's on the market's mind. That's why it's so steep up front at the curve, because the market's saying it takes a lot for these guys at the Fed or the ECB or wherever else to come out of their shell and realize what's going on. Go back to the 2008 case. You're too young for this, but go back to the 2008 case, for example. People forget the ECB was raising interest rates in June of 2008 as the Great Recession was already 7 months old, because they were so engrossed in this inflation narrative, and the Fed wasn't far behind them. You read the discussions from the FOMC meeting back in the middle of 2008. They really thought Bear Stearns was the worst of it, and that they would have to, by the end of 2008, start raising rates because of the inflation pressures that were at least evident to them and embedded in the oil price. So here we have hawkish Fed in the middle of the Great Recession as deflationary money is everywhere. It took Lehman Brothers for them to get snapped out of that inflation fantasy. So what the market is saying is that it takes a lot to get these people who have no idea what's going on in the economy, no idea what's going on in the monetary system, to snap out of their inflationary fantasy and come to terms with reality, come to grips with what's really happening. And so the Fed can continue to hike rates all the way into a recession, maybe quite far into the recession, before it becomes so obvious that they have no choice but to stop and turn around. And I really think that's what the market scenario, or at least the baseline scenario that's been priced in Eurodollar futures, interest rate swaps, as well as the US Treasuries, is that the Fed is so, you know, convinced as well as committed to this theater of hike of trying to tame inflation, that it's going to take a lot to snap them out of it.
Yeah, and so, you know, when you have that sort of situation in your mind, so, you know, one, the potential, that we won't necessarily have to wait 12 to 18 months to see a recession. It could be in a few months. And when you look at Eurodollar futures, if you take the December 2022 future as we speak, it's trading at 97.32, which is expecting a 3-month LIBOR to be at about 2.7%. You've seen the TET spread start to blow out. You know, is there a reason behind this? And do you not think that, you know, the market expecting over eight hikes this year, or like, you know, the Eurodollar future trading and 97.32, do you not think that this is sort of extreme?
No, it is extreme, but yeah, I don't think you take the curve, you don't take the futures contracts literally. You know, those prices are not a prediction. They're sort of a probability distribution. And what they're saying is that, again, up to December 2022, as well as March 2023, the market is relatively convinced that the Fed is going to do a bunch of rate hikes. We don't know how many, but there's going to be a bunch of them coming before they have to come to grips with reality. And I think embedded within that, as you just mentioned, the TED spread, there's some angst and unease about deflationary monetary conditions, which could add to these rate hikes, add another liquidity risk spread on top of the rate hikes, so that 3-month LIBOR isn't just rising because of the Fed, it's rising because the market is actually becoming more and more illiquid. So, you know, 3-month LIBOR could be much higher based on other factors besides whatever Jay Powell decides he needs to get done between now and whatever time he has to stop. And I think that's the more concerning part about all this. And, you know, the Fed, those at the Fed and those in the mainstream would say, well, yeah, the TED spread does tend to rise during rate hike periods because rate hikes are tightening, which is not true. But I think that's something that the market is absolutely concerned about. And so there's almost an additional premium in those front month Eurodollar prices, which is being further repriced in the back end by the level of inversion from you know, June 2023 forward. So it's sort of this combination of not rate hikes, but, you know, what's really going on underneath the surface, which might not be good. And that leads into a whole bunch of other things, including the adoption of SOFR versus, you know, the you know, being forced away from LIBOR. And there's tremendous amount of uncertainties related to that, especially in this type of environment where SOFR doesn't have a history and it's a completely inappropriate relationship to LIBOR. Yet a lot of credit customers have turned to SOFR because they didn't really have much of another choice, especially at the end of last year and the beginning of this year. So tremendous amount of uncertainty across a whole range of issues, including some, you know, plumbing issues too.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you look at the 10-year yield, so that is something that has been rising since especially since the start of this year. And so the yield, the 10-year is at about 2.35%. And so, you know, have there been scenarios, when you look back through history, you know, have there been scenarios when the US 10-year yield has been very wrong about inflation and growth? And so, you know, do you think we're sort of seeing something similar to that right now?
Well, there's two things. Yeah, on a short run basis, nothing's perfect. Even the bond market and bond yields behave on a short run basis that you would, you know, later shake your head at. And, you know, it's not uncommon for nominal yields to rise in these types of conditions. In fact, it's very common. In fact, this is what usually happens during these periods. When the Fed pressures short-term rates, you know, you go on the yield curve out to about 5 years, the Fed has a lot of short-run influence over the front part of the Treasury curve. As it pressures short-term interest rates, some of that gets added into the back end too, because the back end references off the short end. But what happens is when the 10-year starts to resist those short end moves, starts to resist nominal rates rising at the short end, when the yield curve begins to flatten, that's really the key signal here. Not the fact that nominal yields are rising, because you look back at historical recessions where the yield curve flattens in anticipation of them, yields are rising in almost every single case. 2006 is a perfect example, as is 2018. Let's not forget that case too, where nominal yields on the 10-year didn't rise as much as they have this year. But between, you know, early 2018 and their peak in November, you added about, you know, 70, 80 basis points to the nominal 10-year yield before it eventually turned around as the whole thing flattened and then inverted in 2019. So it's not unusual for long-term rates to rise. In fact, it happens all the time. That's not really the signal that we're paying attention to. We're paying attention to, again, the changes in how the curve shape evolves through time. And as it flattens and now inverts, that's a pretty stout signal that rates are not, this is about as high as they're going to go. I don't know much how, you know, they could probably go a little bit higher, but the market is really resisting the short-term pressures on the pressures of the short-run part of the curve.
Got it. And so when you think about the 10-year, you know, the one thing that comes to mind is growth. And on that topic of growth is, I just wanted to get your opinion. So what is your thought? So one paper that has been very controversial when it comes to growth is Reinhardt and Rogoff. And so, you know, what's your thoughts? What are your thoughts on that specific paper?
You mean the specific paper about fiscal deficits?
Growth and its habits. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's obviously historical cases to be made that governments that spend too much and borrow too much are going to be actually not so much, they're actually going to be a drag on economic growth. That's the Japanese case in extreme, is where governments don't help. They tend to get in the way. They tend to be inefficient about how they redistribute resources, whether it be helicopter drops or just rather, you know, transfer payments like we saw last year. They tend to make more of a mess, not less of a mess. And that's, you know, it's usually the case. And once governments reach a certain point where they're just intervening all the time, it's a hindrance to economic growth. So I think the mechanism that Reinhardt and Rogoff proposed, maybe I don't agree as much with, but I think they made a pretty compelling case that whatever the issue, whatever the mechanism, when governments get too much involved, it doesn't lead to very good outcomes. And I happen to believe it's because governments are responding to weak economic cases because they're all Keynesians. And Keynesians believe that whenever aggregate demand, or what they call aggregate demand, is weak, the government needs to step in. So if you have a weak economy, the government's always going to be stepping in. And so the two things kind of go together.
Yeah, I see. Moving on, I wanted to talk a bit about the US dollar and, you know, your favorite word in the world, printing. You know, one thing that we saw recently was that the Saudis were actually willing to sell oil to the Chinese in yuan. And this was, you know, a lot of people started talking about how this was the beginning.
Just like the Petrowan in 2018. I mean, the idea is that Saudis are going to create a parallel currency. You just got to shake your head and laugh.
But is that meaningful at all? Or Does that?
No, it's not. Yeah. You know, there was a lot of people in early 2018, late 2017, who said the Petrowan, it's a game changer. The US dollar is toast. And then the irony was, almost 2 weeks after the Petrowan finally debuted, the dollar started moving higher, and it's only higher ever since, because there is no petrodollar. Petrodollar is a misunderstanding of the eurodollar system. It's people who have glimpsed that there is an offshore outside US dollar system and have associated it with oil for some reason. I don't really know why, but they've made oil the central part of the global currency or the global economic system, when in financial terms, in real money terms, oil is a drop in the bucket. It's not a proverbial drop in the bucket. It's a small part of it. Now, it's not for Saudi Arabia. It's not for Russia. Obviously, their entire economy is based around oil. But for the global economic system and the global reserve currency that serves it, oil just isn't that important. It is an important part of the economy, but it's not the primary thing which motivates people to use the Eurodollar system to transact in across, you know, markets everywhere else. And since we have a Eurodollar problem and have had a Eurodollar problem for going on 15 years now, it hasn't been uncommon for certain parties, the Chinese, the Russians, whoever else, to try to work their way around this dollar shortage issue. And bilateral trading is the easiest way to do it. So in one sense, the Saudis, you know, agreeing to transact oil in the terms outside of the dollar isn't a threat to the dollar system. It's an acknowledgement of the shortcomings in that system that remains. And so this the amount of hype on the petroleum, petrodollar, petyuan, and this, it just, That's the reason why these things never come to fruition, because you're placing too much importance on something that, for the entire system as a whole, really doesn't amount to all that much.
And is there actually a role that commodities play within the, or is there an important role that commodities play within the Eurodollar system? And, you know, are the recent spikes in commodity prices, you know, at all meaningful to the functioning of the Eurodollar system?
Sure, they can play an important role. In fact, you know, commodities are collateral in a lot of, you know, merchandise arrangements, but not so much, even in some financial arrangements too. But, you know, that's not so much a breakdown in the system as it is redistribution, right? I mean, because you have prices that go up for certain things that, again, the flood of resources toward those things and away from others. So without actual money printing, without actual increase in the systemic level of euro dollars, quote unquote, and it's just nothing more than redistribution. And it can cause cause market disruptions, as we've seen in certain places like nickel, for example. That's certainly, if you were short nickel, it's a bad day for you, lots of days for you. But that's not necessarily a systemic issue that's going to break down the entire global monetary system. I think you got more worry about from SOFR and LIBOR than you do from the commodity prices and commodity markets.
Got it. Well, back in April 2020, you tweeted that, you know, the oil market is looking at past massive production cuts and government buying, looking at the intermediate term economic conditions long after the economy shutdown is lifted and pricing serious economic damage like the IMF, more L than V. And so has there been a change of your view on the L versus V scenario, you know, in terms of the recovery pattern that you outlined in April 2020? And so, you know, if there is a change, you know, what contributed to that change in assessment?
No, I think we still have a lack of recovery. And I think that the consumer prices last year have essentially muddied that picture, because it looked like the economy was robustly recovering. When you take out the prices, whether it's commodities, whether it's consumer prices in the aggregate, and you look at the overall level of volumes across not just the US, but the rest of the world, you just have to shake your head and say, look, here we are in 2022. We've had massive government interventions all over the place. And in terms of, you know, something like global trade, the actual volume of trade going back and forth around the world, it's less than it was in many places in 2020, which was already less than it was in 2018. So we have volumes of trade and volumes of production and volumes of manufacturing that are less today than they were 4 or 5 years ago. That's not a recovery. That's not a V shape. What happened was, because supply was so constrained, really the logistical part of it, shipping goods around, prices rose because of the supply demand imbalance. Again, supply shock case. That didn't mean the economy was recovering robustly. It just meant that supply was coming back faster than demand. The other way around. Demand was coming back faster than supply. And supply and the level of actual volume in the economy has been utterly disappointing, thoroughly disappointing, especially again when you factor the fact that governments have been intervening all over the place. You know, we've got trillions of dollars in fiscal intervention, and this is it. This is all we got. We got an inflation shock or a consumer price shock, and not much of a recovery outside of it. I mean, even in the United States, I know people like to talk about a labor shortage, but we have millions of jobs less now than we did 2 years ago. And that doesn't count the 4 or 5 million, maybe 6 million jobs that should have happened that never did. We're like 8 million jobs short. That's not a recovery. And that's not a labor shortage. That is an L-shaped, that's an L-shaped recovery.
Not a V-shaped recovery. And you know, taking that phenomenon a few decades back, you know, what is the reason that interest rates and growth have been declining since the 80s? Is it just mostly based on demographics and the slowing slowing growth rate of the labor force, or are there other reasons that are involved with why rates and growth have actually been declining since the 80s?
Well, first of all, you got to remember, it's not just the United States economy, it's the global economy. And so even though the U.S. economy has decelerated since the 1980s, the global economy, especially parts of Asia and emerging markets, have absolutely accelerated. So when you look at the global economy as a whole, again, taking account for redistribution, you know, the offshoring of manufacturing jobs from the U.S. out to the rest of the world, all of it financed by expanding euro dollar money and credit, there was no slowdown there. There was actually acceleration and a fair bit of sustainable prosperity. Look at places like China, for example. China started out in the 1980s a backwards communist outpost, a backwater, you know, a subsistence agricultural economy. Today, it's a global economic powerhouse. That was real transformation done during the same period. So you have U.S. Treasury rates reflected that actual global growth prospects and global growth results. At the same time, however, you didn't have the same level of consumer price inflation. So that, I think, accounts for why interest rates started to fall after the late 1970s and early 1980s, was the fact that most of the attention of the Eurodollar system transited toward investment in these offshore and the overseas places from the perspective of the U.S. So you have better growth, but a whole hell of a lot less of consumer price inflation, not just in the U.S., but across the rest of the world. You had this globalization wave that created a real level of prosperity, which meant interest rates could be relatively stable and normal for a prolonged period of time, as they were, especially in the 90s and middle 2000s. It's only since really the middle 2000s, 2008 to be specific, that interest rates have really fallen to their low levels. And that's a period of disinflation in the United States, as well as deflation around the rest of the world, as economic growth that we got during that, you know, great so-called great moderation, the 90s and middle 2000s, around the rest of the world, that's just all dried up and almost disappeared. So it's not surprising that interest rates went lower after 2008, just as it's not surprising they went lower throughout the 80s and 90s.
And so has the growth that we've seen since the recession sort of fake or, you know, not real? You know, if you compare this to say what happened during say the 80s or the 90s, you know, over the last 10 or 12 years, has that just been, you know, what has actually driven the last 10 to 12 years of growth?
Well, you know, again, you can pinpoint exactly what happened because of when it happened, really, right? We were growing, the United States was growing at a relatively decent, stable rate. Productivity seemed to be, you know, at least modest. Everything seemed to be really good. A little bit of a dip in maximum growth in the middle 2000s, which is consistent with offshoring as well as too much attention to real estate and finance. But by and large, the economy was stable throughout the 80s and 90s, which is why they called it the Great Moderation. And then all of a sudden, 2007, 2008, the economy takes a dive and never comes back. And I think that's the part most people miss, is that they think that, you know, GDP is at record highs, therefore the economy must be doing really well. The unemployment rate is at a 50-year low, therefore the economy must be doing really well, when in fact, both of those numbers are misleading. The GDP number in the U.S. is misleading because it doesn't show you how far off trend we've gone since 2008. In fact, we keep going farther and farther and farther off trend, because not only did the economy drop off in 2008, 2009, when it never came back, that meant the growth rate after the trough of the Great Recession has been less than the growth rate that preceded the recession. So it's a double whammy in that sense, which has led to this participation problem in the labor force, which means there just are not enough jobs to go around, that American workers dropped out of the labor force and never came back to it. So the unemployment rate doesn't take into account the participation problem, and that doesn't take, and nobody takes into account the fact that the GDP is misleading because it's so far off the prior trend. We have this confusion about what actually has happened over the last dozen years or so. And the problem, the real problem is, this is not just an American phenomenon. This is not just an issue for the U.S. economy. You go over to Europe, you find the same problem. GDP fell off 2007 and 2008, and it never came back. And then you go around to the rest of the world. You look at China. China initially survived the 2008 and 2009 recession relatively well, but by 2011, with these repeated problems, China has fallen off too. And now the Chinese are talking about 5.5% GDP growth as if that's some kind of miracle achievement, when in 2008, 9% was considered recession. So the entire global economy over the last dozen years has been in a persistent drag, in a persistent deflationary rut, that most people don't even appreciate the fact that that's what's actually happened. There's this, you know, this idea, even before 2020, that the U.S. economy was booming in particular, as well as over the last year, that the economy is so red hot, it's created actual consumer price inflation. And all of those things have been completely misleading. When you look at the actual numbers behind everything, especially volume numbers, global trade, manufacturing, services spending in the U.S., everything is way off.
This has become a different economy compared to what was healthy, say, in the 2000s or the 90s or the 80s.
The two things are incomparable, which, you know, again, that makes sense why financial markets are pricing what they're pricing, is because when you look at why the yield curve inversion, how fast that developed over the last, you know, couple of weeks or a couple of months, it's a nod to the fact that the market knows this economy is not red hot. It's not booming. It's actually quite weak and susceptible to the kind of negative shocks that produce a recession. And in a weakened state, it doesn't take a whole lot to reach that tipping point. And I think that's why not only curves are the way they are, but how quickly they got into that shape. Again, you could see this coming a mile. You could see it coming back from last October. As soon as that flood of inventory reached the American shores, it was like the market said, okay, that's it. We don't have a recovery here. We've got rising recessionary, deflationary prospects. And they've been hedging ever since.
Yeah. And so, you know, on the topic of the yield curve, you know, going back to that, the 10-year 3-month and the 10-year 2-year have actually diverged quite significantly. You know, you mentioned how the 10-year 2-year actually inverted yesterday. And, you know, we're recording on the 30th of March, and so yesterday was the 29th of March. And on the other hand, if you look at the 10-year versus the 3-month, you know, you don't really see that happening. And so, you know, why is there a divergence? And, you know, is that meaningful at all?
Yeah, it's like we said before, that the short end of the curve is pricing, you know, unfettered rate hikes for the foreseeable future. And it's not just Eurodollar futures is the same way. And so the 3-month is going to be down where the current rate structure is. And as long as the Fed has given this room to do what it wants, regardless of reality, regardless of economic reality or anything else, there's going to be some steepness on the front of the curve. That's not unusual. In fact, it's outside of 2008 or 2006 and 2007, it is pretty much standard stuff where you see the curve look like this. It's sharp at the front end and then flat from the front to the all the way to the back, if not inverted. That shape is common. It happened in early 2000 at the top of the dot-com bubble, predicting the dot-com recession. It happened in 1990, predicting the 91 recession. So the fact that the 3-month 10-year spread isn't signaling recession just means that the market isn't in the place where it thinks that the Fed is going to turn around just yet. That's all it means. It's all really about the Fed, when the information content about the actual economy growth and inflation prospects are all in the flat and inverted curve in the back. In fact, that it's, you know, 2-year all the way out into the 30-year, the entire long end of the curve, the middle, long, all of it is completely flat and inverted in so many places. And how much it is inverted, that's what you need to be focused on.
Yeah. And when it comes to, and, you know, as you were talking about Eurodollar futures and just in general, you know, the rates market pricing and unfettered rate hikes, you know, have you found, and I know that you're not a trader, you're more focused on research, et cetera, but have you found any indicators that, you know, have been very useful at, you know, in telling the top in yields, or, you know, when to go ahead and buy Eurodollar futures and, you know, in a sense, bet on rate hikes not being so fast?
Yeah, it's tough to time. And again, because that's, you know, you can't take the contracts in Eurodollar futures literally, nor something like TIPS or even the yield curve, for example. But, you know, usually, historically speaking, you see these long end inversions just in the treasury curve, for example, It usually is the top. That's usually it. Usually the rates don't rise much further beyond that point because the market is saying we're hedging for the other side of this thing because we believe we've gotten to that point. So, you know, even 1994, for example, at the end of the 94 massacre, when that curve inverted just a tiny fraction of a little bit in December of 94 and January of 95, that was it. Rates were already starting to head lower, even at that point. And even though the Fed hadn't even done its final rate hike, that came in February of 1995, which was a 50 basis point hike. So rates were already lower before Greenspan had stopped raising rates in the 94-95 period too. And you can go back and see the same thing in 2005-2006, where you had the inversion in 2006, and that was pretty much the top. It didn't get any farther than that. Once the curve inverted, it kind of fluctuated out of inversion, and then late 2006, it inverted more, and then that was it. So the fact that the yield curve is inverted is a pretty powerful and compelling signal that this might be as far as it gets in terms of long-term yields. And then you look at Eurodollar futures and say, where is the Fed going to stop? And Eurodollar futures are starting to say, yeah, that's probably correct too. We don't know when, because you can't look at the June 2023 pivot and say it's June 2023. It's just that what that means is that because it's inverted from June 2023 forward, that the market is predicting the Fed will stop before it currently believes it will be able to. Because remember, the Fed is thinking this year as well as next year, and then some terminal rate beyond there. And the Eurodollar futures market is saying, you're going to stop before you think you're going to.
Yeah. And you know, when you think about just in general, the Eurodollar market, you know, are the Eurodollar system, you know, when you know, what are the best indicators that, you know, you've noticed throughout your career of identifying when the Eurodollar system is actually in a state of turmoil or is sort of entering a state of turmoil?
You know, a flattening curve, that's always a good one. It's an easy one that tells you that something's wrong because markets are hedging when they really shouldn't be hedging. I mean, an ideal curve, whether it be Eurodollar futures or treasury curve, is modestly upward sloping. That's hopeful. That's optimistic because you think, you know, rates are going to be higher in the future, which contrary to popular perception is a good thing, not a bad thing. And so upward sloping, any shape that's outside of upward sloping is already, okay, something's not right here. And if it's inverted, that means something's really not right here. And you can go outside of that for something, you know, if you want to check your assumptions on those curves, look at interest rate swaps and swap spread, for example, because an interest rate swap includes in its, you know, embedded in its price, short-term interest rates. And if you think short-term interest rates are going to be rising and stick rising and stay up, like the Fed is actually doing something the market agrees with, you would expect swap spreads to start decompressing in some material fashion, along with, you know, the monetary balance sheet information that's embedded in swap spreads too. We would expect them to be rising. And if they're not, that's, again, that's a signal something's wrong. Just the price of the dollar's exchange value, something simple like that. When the dollar goes up, that doesn't mean the U.S. is the cleanest, dirty shirt. It means the dollars are in short supply, generally speaking, around the rest of the world. So what has the U.S. dollar done, even as CPIs have gone through the roof? Well, it backed off a little bit, you know, late last year and early this year. But, you know, over the last couple months here, the dollar has gone higher. Even though a lot of that is against the euro, it's also the Japanese yen. Why is the Japanese yen falling so much? So there's a number of indications that are embedded in the U.S. dollar exchange value that when you put all of these things together, it's not one thing or another. And I think that's kind of the case that I tried to make back in October when things really started to move. It was like, okay, if it's just Eurodollar futures, that's enough of a warning. But if that's the only thing that we see, then it's probably, maybe there's a technical issue. But if it's all of these things and all of them doing the same things at the same time, that's a pretty solid indication that at some point we're into the opposite case, which is, you know, the deflationary monetary case.
And do you think that, you know, once we get over with the supply shocks, you know, or the supply chain issues, you know, we're going to go back into a similar period like the 2010 to 2020 cycle?
If not worse. That is the, we really want to be, you know, we really want to be brought down and you know, pessimistic about things. The fact that these curves are topping out where they are, which is less than where they topped out in 2018, assuming it stays this way, nothing changes over the short run. You know, that's a pretty, you know, what that's saying, long run potential is somehow less than it was over the previous decade. if this is the best that we're going to see for interest rates and it's less than it was at the top in 2018, then the long run implication is that the 2020s, at least as it stands right now, might not be as good as the 2010s. And the 2010s were not good. And that's understandable, though, because think about it. We went through this ridiculous, massive recession in 2020. Did anybody really believe that we would get through that massive interruption, that artificial shutdown, without taking any long-run economic damage? Did people actually expect we would come out of the other side of it and the economy would go, no big deal? I mean, we shut down businesses. They went out of business. We've lost so much potential because of what happened that eventually that long-run reduction in actual economic potential as well as monetary and financial prospects, those were gonna harm, or show their harm to the real economy at some point. And I think we're starting to see that emerge from behind this cloud of consumer price acceleration due to the supply imbalance of last year. We're starting to see markets price it, as well as more and more data is agreeing with the prospects for that kind of demand destruction, not just from consumer prices, but the long-term demand destruction that we got, that we unwisely added onto a weak situation in 2020.
And you know, as we're coming out of this and we're seeing, we see the Fed wanting to hike rates, or the market expecting the Fed to hike 8 times this year. The Fed is actually going after consumption. And, you know, how far do you agree with the fact that, you know, consumption, you know, if you go after consumption and you destroy demand, you know, it becomes very hard to actually bring that back after, considering the fact that you've got a midterm election in the middle. And so if you have a mixed House or mixed Congress in general, you know, it becomes very hard to pass bills, et cetera, that would actually help bring consumption back. So do you think that, you know, the policy mistake is actually greater than what most people would perceive it to be?
I don't think it's a policy mistake at all. I mean, history has shown that rate hikes don't matter. I mean, go back to 2005, 2006. Greenspan hiked rates 17 times, 25 basis points apiece, from 1% Fed funds rate, or Fed funds target, to 5.25%. And the economy didn't skip a beat. Didn't slow down whatsoever. In fact, the housing bubble continued on to its most insane levels, which is what really, that's what the conundrum was. That's what the bond market was saying. It's like, these rate hikes aren't doing anything, Alan. In fact, this is going to lead to a deflationary consequence, which is what's going to actually get the economy in trouble. That's where the demand destruction came from, not the rate hikes themselves. The rate hikes, again, were all theater. And I think the same in 2017, 2018, where the rate hikes didn't cause a global downturn and recession pre-COVID. That was all of the problems and mistakes and misreading of what, you know, quote unquote, globally synchronized growth wasn't. It was not a robust recovery whatsoever. It's just that the central bankers and economists had to try to proclaim that it was, because they wanted to be let off the hook. They wanted to claim success that wasn't there. And so the rate hikes didn't spoil the party. There was never a party to begin with. And I think we're in the same type of issue here. And so that, you know, to your point, that makes it even more difficult, because we're assigning blame to the Fed, who deserves blame for other reasons that have nothing to do with the rate hikes. And so we're not even correctly putting all the dots together, which, as you said, leaves the government to step in and try to fix a problem it doesn't understand, nor is it equipped to actually solve, which just makes it even worse and increases the probabilities that we don't have a recovery, which means we just keep repeating these mistakes over and over and over again. So it's one big, huge mess that, understandably, the public is saying, enough, you know, this stuff doesn't work. So let's try something radical like MMT. Or let's try something even more radical, like adopt complete socialism, you know, because none of what's been offered either even explains what we've been through, let alone has a prayer of fixing it. And it's not so much a policy error as it is misunderstanding the entire situation from the ground up.
You know, if you were the Fed, you know, does it really matter, you know, what you do? So even if you keep rates low and try to help supply, do you think that would actually make a difference, or does it just not matter what the Fed does at all?
No, the Fed is just, it's just an outdated institution. It has no place in the modern economy. And so it's left to try to manipulate emotion, which in some places it has had more success than others. Thinking about stocks and real estate, for example, it has had a tremendous sentimental impact on stocks. even if it has zero impact on the real economy, which of course makes everything worse. Because if you're in the real economy that's horrible and you're on the wrong end of the horrible real economy and you see the stock market zooming up to record prices, even after a COVID recession that was among the worst in history, you kind of get the wrong idea, as well as you get a little bit angry about things. And so it is entirely unhelpful to be left to the Federal Reserve, to be left as this psychological manipulator that doesn't actually add anything to the situation. In fact, it probably makes it worse, let alone when you get down into the monetary details of the Fed taking bonds that the market actually wants. Market wants to use collateral. We need more of it. So, you know, the idea that the Fed can help, or, you know, how do we get the Fed to help? I think we need the Fed to get the hell out of the way and start doing something else, or reform itself to be something more useful in the way things actually work, not the way that we're all told it's supposed to work, you know, the Greenspan put and all that nonsense. The Fed just isn't a central bank. It's not part of the monetary system, at least not a big part of the monetary system, that it can actually make a difference. And so all it does is it confuses the public. It confuses the hell out of the public because nobody can make sense of these things.
I remember that, and correct me if I'm misquoting you, but in a Real Vision interview, I think it was in 2020 or 2021, you sort of described the Federal Reserve to be a fire station where, you know, in the sense that it doesn't have the ability to start a fire, it just has the tools to put them out. And do you think that they don't have the tools to put them out at the moment?
I don't know if I've ever used that analogy. I think I called them a janitor, which is they come in after the mess has been made and try to clean it up so that people don't fixate too much on the mess. That was certainly, you know, that's... If you actually pin down Jay Powell and say, what is it that you actually do? He would admit to you that we're not a central bank, certainly not in the way that Walter Badgett had imagined way back in the 19th century, the traditional central bank that is the lender of last resort, that is the means by which we can instill some currency elasticity on a system where money is being hoarded or it's in short supply. That's what a central bank is supposed to do. And if it does it effectively, you don't have a crisis in the first place. Because if money becomes inelastic and the Fed comes in and supplies money that the private market won't, there is no crisis. But again, if you put a gun to Jay Powell's head, he would tell you that's not what we do. What we do is what they call nowadays market of last resort, which isn't even that. It's essentially after money becomes inelastic, it becomes a massive crisis. After all the damage has been done, the Fed tries to buy certain asset classes to create a psychological a wave of positive emotion that the private market then buys assets alongside the Fed. And then those markets start to normalize, which then maybe has a normalization effect on the rest of the economy. So they come in like a janitor after everything has already been broken down and try to clean up a little bit, hoping that cleaning up a little bit actually creates the seeds of recovery, when that's never been the case. So again, misunderstanding what the Fed actually is and what it actually does. And if you look at the Fed and listen to them closely enough, they'll tell you that's what they do. They are not a central bank. They are not an agent of currency elasticity. They're a janitor. And, you know, during times of crisis, or even during times of after the crisis, if you realize what the Fed actually is and that there is no elasticity, there is no Greenspan put, the world's a much riskier, more dangerous place. And so if you are that private market, if you are the money dealers in the system, and you realize push comes to shove, you can't depend on a janitor because a janitor doesn't come in until after it's over. It explains a good deal of why the monetary system doesn't grow, why it remains so risk averse that, you know, hedge funds, their only leverage nowadays is to speculate on basis trades on US treasuries, for example. Everything is about safe and liquid because the Fed is an essential bank. It's a janitor. It's market of last resort nonsense rather than effective lender of last resort as we're supposed to have.
I see. And you know, earlier this month, Zoltan Pashar, who's, I guess, another well-respected person when it comes to monetary economics, published a piece titled Bretton Woods 3. And he started that by saying, we are witnessing the birth of Bretton Woods III, a new world order, a new world monetary order centered around commodity-based currencies in the East that will likely weaken the Eurodollar system and also contribute to inflationary forces in the West. You know, how far do you agree with that? Do you agree with that at all?
Zoltan tends to fixate on bank reserves because he's basically a Fed guy. And so his whole worldview is bank reserves and carry trades, and takes very little awareness or factors in collateral and all the rest of the euro dollars. Although it was nice he actually used the term euro dollar for the first time. So maybe he's actually starting to get with the program and understand what the actual system is. But by and large, this idea that there's a commodity-based regional block in the East, I mean, I don't buy that at all. We went over the reasons for it because that's such a small part of the overall financial flows, let alone merchandise flows around the rest of the world. You know, a commodity-based block between China, Russia, and a few others isn't going to help with trade across the entire global economic system. So no, I don't, you know, Bretton Woods 3, what was Bretton Woods 2? So we didn't even get that one. I, the euro dollar sort of arose organically out of the shadows in the 1950s, not long after Bretton Woods 1 was actually, you know, it was only 14, 15 years old, not even that long. It was 11, 12 years old when the euro dollar really started to take over. So in one sense, the Bretton Woods system didn't really last all that long. And was the euro dollar Bretton Woods 2? I don't really think so, but it certainly took over the roles of a global reserve currency not long after the first one started. So what, you know, there needs to be another global currency arrangement, but the last thing we would want is people like, the insiders like Zoltan and others who are fixated on all the wrong things to try to redesign a currency system. It ends up with like, it would end up like the first Bretton Woods. It would last for a couple of years and then it would all just fall apart.
And, you know, when you touch on that topic of Bretton Woods starting in the 1940s and then, you know, about 10, 15 years or so later, the euro dollar system is sort of born. When it comes to the inflation of the 1970s, you know, why isn't the euro dollar system actually given more attention, or the expansion of the euro dollar system given more attention relative to, say, the collapse of Bretton Woods, the various food and oil shortages that happened within that period?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is that there was official blackout over the entire, I mean, you can understand why American officials are not wanting to advertise that there is an overseas US dollar denominated currency system that is maintained and monitored by banks, by global banks like Deutsche Bank or, you know, UBS in Switzerland. They're the actual US dollar system. You know, they were not going to advertise that during the Cold War in the 60s and 70s, especially during the Great Inflation. And then the other problem is, nobody understood it. You know, there's a famous quote from Milton Friedman who wrote about the Eurodollar system, and I think it was July or August of 1969. It was titled Eurodollar, Some First Principles. And one of the opening quotes is he recounted meeting what he said was a high official. He didn't say who it was. I don't think he wanted to embarrass the guy. And this high official in 1969 was asked to explain where all these Eurodollars were coming from. And he said, you know, balance of payments and bank deposits and all these other things. And Friedman nailed him and said, this was just utter nonsense. The point being that even politicians and central bankers and monetary officials around the world, they didn't understand the damn thing when it was happening. So you have a bunch of bankers operating in this political shadows throughout for decades, doing what they were doing, expanding not just quantitatively, but qualitatively in ways that economists and officials just couldn't keep up with. Of course, they didn't get much attention because they didn't understand it and they didn't want anybody to know about it. And then after Volcker, the myth of Paul Volcker, this legend was born that nobody needed to, because the Fed could raise interest rates in the short run to however they wanted to, and they would control everything. So they didn't need to know the nitty-gritty Eurodollar details. You know, Alan Greenspan would hike the Fed funds rate and let the banks sort them all out. This, the height of hubris, that after Volcker, we wouldn't even need to understand the monetary system because it was so easy, like snapping your fingers. And so that's why the Eurodollar never really got attention during the Great Inflation. I mean, imagine that. You have this worldwide inflationary wave. At the same time, the monetary system was radically redrawn into an unconstrained format. Boy, what a coincidence, right? And then afterwards, we have this myth of Volcker and then Greenspan, where we don't even need to study much. Eurodollar, that's ancient news. And so monetary scholarship as a whole just dried up in the 80s and 90s, and nobody paid attention, not just Eurodollars, but repo and everything else, derivatives, until 2007, and it all came back to bite us. So the fact that most people haven't heard of the Eurodollar is down to the fact that it's just an incredibly complicated place with a very torturous history.
Yeah. And so, you know, to that end, the Fed really lost power in the late 1950s, early 1960s, when the Eurodollar system was actually born, rather than, say, you know, 2007 or 8 or whatever.
And you can see that. I mean, that's what the great inflation was. It wasn't the Fed that printed money. It was the banking system. Once the banking system found these ways to go outside of especially Regulation Q and some of the Depression era regulations, as well as outside the Fed and its control, unconstrained monetary growth. And it was experimentation and everything else. And so globally, you got all these dollars traversing the world. At the same time, nobody wanted to point the finger at the Eurodollar because that would be admitting way, way too much that the public just wasn't ready for. But you could already see, as you said, Sri, in the late 1950s, the formation of the London Gold Pool in November 1961 was a tacit admission by the major global powers that Bretton Woods was already done. The London Gold Pool, by sharing and combining national reserves on the offshore London market for dollars, was saying Bretton Woods didn't work. It's done. It's over with. It was an admission. Something else is going on here. And it didn't get any better. I mean, by the 1967, you had a two-tiered gold price. So even in the official mechanisms under Bretton Woods, you could tell that something wasn't right, that it was all wrong. It was going in the wrong direction. So by the time you get to August 1971, that was just a mere formality to, you know, 16 years of history before that. And that includes, by the way, the petrodollar, which isn't a thing. Because before then, you have this Eurodollar market that already exists. And by the time you have the OPEC oil, the oil surge and the embargo in 1973, there was no need for a secret arrangement for oil producers to buy treasuries. They were already doing that to begin with. They were already holding their dollar balances outside the United States in this offshore arrangement where the bank said, you want to hold liquidity in treasuries? No problem. We're already doing that. And so the petrodollar wasn't a separate thing. It was just part of what was already going on. The whole system evolved long before we got to the 70s.
Yeah. And so Paul Volcker basically did not do anything at all when he reached to, you know, 20%, and, you know, Paul Volcker became this great hero. So you should
read the transcripts from the late 70s, early 80s. Those guys were just so confused about everything. They had the idea that they provoked recessions to tame the great inflation. It doesn't bear any scrutiny whatsoever. You read through these transcripts and they're absolutely shocked that there was a recession in 80. They were shocked there was another recession in 1881. They had no idea. They had gross monetary confusion. They didn't know what targets to keep track of. All they did was, again, like Jay Powell is doing today, was the appearance of doing something about inflation that was wildly out of control, as well as appearing to rescue the US dollar, which at that point, far more serious global political backlash to it than even now. So the Volcker, all he was doing was playing along in the theater. And then afterwards, the Volcker myth was sort of, you know, it was sort of reverse engineered or reinvented, gaslighting what was going on to say, oh, we meant to do that. We meant to provoke these recessions. And if you don't, you dare do it again, because if you provoke us, we'll create another recession. And so from there, the Volcker myth took over. And as I just wrote recently, the shame of that is that there was monetary, real honest to God goodness, monetary investigations throughout the 60s and 70s. There was an investigation of the Eurodollar system. I quoted testimony from in front of Congress in 1977, talking about how the Eurodollar was actually, what it was actually doing. And then the Volcker myth happened and everything just dried up and everything was left to its own devices in the shadows. And the inevitable result was 2008. And now we're paying the price for it, paying the price for it.
Yeah. But this does mean that, you know, Volcker hiking rates was the thing that actually caused the recession. Is that what you're saying?
Even though there was any number of problems, including the fact that oil prices spiked yet again.
Yeah.
Every time oil prices spike, that's enough on its own for a recession. 1973, perfect example, the original oil embargo. You had an inflationary monetary inflation underneath that, and then oil prices spiked. We had one of the nastiest recessions in the post-war history, lasted all the way through 1974 into 1975. That wasn't the Fed, it was oil prices. So it's the same thing in late 1979. Yeah. You have Iran taking over. Iran gets cut off. The oil supply gets cut off. Next thing you've got oil shortages.
That's one of the reasons, but it's not the only reason. Yeah. And so are there any parallels to the 1970s versus now? So one is that the Fed is absolutely confused on what to do. But then, you know, looking at commodities, you see a parallel there, you know, where we saw commodity prices go through the roof in the 70s. And we're sort of seeing a similar dynamic take place right now.
I think you have the similar dynamic in terms of the Fed being confused, but where it's absolutely different is you don't have the excessive monetary creation. So you have the underlying monetary creation that created the inflation that the supply shocks added on top of. And that's where you have the stagflation of the 1970s. And I think, you know, it's an important point to remember too, that during the 1970s, the Federal Reserve was looked at very differently. In fact, its entire history from 1929 forward, people laughed at the Fed. The Fed was not an institution you took seriously. It was a joke, because why wouldn't it be? They had the Great Depression, which was not supposed to happen with the Federal Reserve or the central bank. You have the great inflation, which is not supposed to happen if the central bank is doing its job. The Fed was a joke because it doesn't understand what it's supposed to be doing. It's essentially a political animal that is not constituted to accomplish its dual roles. And that much has been the same throughout the 80s, 90s, as well as the 2010s and 2020s, but we don't have the monetary creation that we did in the 1970s. And so, yeah, there are a lot of combination, a lot of the same factors, but we don't have the underlying oversupply of money.
Like within your framework, you know, what are the odds of stagflation over, say, the next 5 years or so?
I don't think that's a high, I don't think that happens either. Because I think what we're seeing now priced in the curves, in all these inverted curves and markets everywhere, is that the resolution to consumer and commodity prices is at hand. And unfortunately, the resolution is a downturn or recession or worse. So once we go through that, like we did in, say, 2011 or 2008, and I'm not saying we're going to repeat those periods, but I'm just saying that the pattern is potentially the same. You don't see the reigniting of consumer prices on the other side of it like you did in the 1970s, because you don't have the money there. And so the supply shock last year, transitory temporary supply shock, once it's resolved, and if it's resolved in the way we think it's going, the way markets are pricing it today, that's it. It's a isolated one-off case that we'll talk about in history, but it won't last beyond the next downturn, because the downturn is itself the other side of the supply shock. That's the closing chapters of that story.
And you know, when it comes to, for example, when we look at March 2020, the Federal Reserve quote unquote printed money, and you know, everyone thought that everything went back to normal. You know, they've, you know, provided the economy with so much liquidity that you'd see stock prices go up, and stock prices did go up, but then you know, how long can they actually keep playing this game of where, you know, we see stocks go down, we see the economy go into recession, and then, you know, the Fed, you know, does some amount of quantitative easing, and then, you know, everything goes back to normal. So how long does that, you know, when does this game sort of end?
Well, that's the thing. Not everything does go back to normal. So, you know, stock prices have no trouble because they're not anchored in any sort of reality, but the real economy doesn't. And that's really the problem. And how long can the Fed maintain this inequality? For quite a long period of time. I mean, you need to look only at the Bank of Japan to see an example of an inept, corrupt institution maintaining itself, doing nothing helpful over decade after decade after decade. And if you want to take a long-run pessimistic view, that's our future. I don't think we can maintain ourselves for 40 years in that position, but a central bank has done it. And it's a central bank of which ours seems intent following along very closely, time and time and time again. And there were some really severe recessions that the Bank of Japan did nothing to prevent, did nothing to help, did nothing to normalize on the other side of it. Yet here they are. It's 2022, doing the same things that they've done for years and decades. And there's nobody who says we need to turn the lights out on the Bank of Japan. So the Fed can keep playing this game so long as the public is really confused. And that's really the issue here. Like, we keep coming back to that, is so long as nobody puts all these pieces together in a coherent fashion, the Fed can play this middle part where they say, well, maybe what we're doing is, you know, it's job saved. It would have been worse without us. It's not great, but hey, without us, it would have been 1929 all over again, and nobody can prove the counterfactual.
There's one more topic that I wanted to talk about on this podcast, and so that's the topic of gold. And so, you know, within the current monetary environment, you know, what role does gold actually play?
Not much of one, unfortunately. I mean, I'm a fan of gold. In my youth, I dreamed of going back to a gold standard because, you know, the allure of hard money constraint as a cure for all our current evils. You know, people think that I'm a euro dollar advocate when I'm anything but. You know, when I keep talking about the euro dollar system, I keep talking about a shortage of collateral and how that's treasury price positive. Those don't mean I agree with those things. I think those are problems that need to be solved. And in one sense, a hard money gold-backed system would be a resolution to it. Unfortunately, gold was demonetized 3/4 of a century ago. I mean, a long, long time ago. We're going back a long time. And ever since then, again, we talked about the breakdown of Bretton Woods. Really, by 1960, even gold exchange was an anachronism. So for the last 3/4 of a century, we've been kind of doing something else anyway. And really, unless we're really willing to go back to a full-blown gold standard where you and I are walking around with silver rather than gold, silver coins in our pocket, real true convertibility, there really isn't any point to gold price rules and gold exchange. There's really no point to those things. Unless we're going to go back to a gold standard, the real thing, then it's almost, there's really not much purpose to it. And I think most people, they're not going to carry silver coins around in their pocket. They want to go into the grocery store and tap their card on the little machine and walk out with goods and service, or walk out with goods. They want to go to the pump and use their phone to pay. They want to shop on Amazon, and Amazon is not going to wait till you deliver silver coins before they ship the goods to you from China. So we're looking at some form of a digital standard. And because of that, and because of the fact that gold has been demonetized for so long, what is the role for gold in the actual monetary system? I don't think it really has a place. That doesn't mean it has no role. It doesn't mean it has no value. It can be a hedge. It can be a bridge. It can be a transactionary period between one thing and another. But I don't think it has a place as, you know, a key part of the monetary system.
So would you actually advocate a return back to the gold standard system?
No, because, you know, is in an idealistic, you know, situation, you think, yeah, that would be great. And I think people, you know, gold enthusiasts and advocates tend to romanticize the gold standard era. But when the historical fact of the matter is that hard money, constrained money, a gold-based system like we had in the 19th century or had around the world didn't really work out all that well. Because while it kept prices stable, it also brought about widespread depressions at a frighteningly regular intervals. And the reason is because in a hard money situation, those with money tend to hoard it. And so that's what gave us central banks, because rich people tended to hoard scarce money because they could. And it made sense to do that. And we don't want to go back to that type of situation where we left with the fact that money becomes so inelastic, it becomes backwards elastic, and then we're left with a central bank to try to fix it. I think we need a more dynamic arrangement where we have some level of monetary constraint, but not too much of a constraint or a fixed money system. At the same time, we don't want to go where the Eurodollar went, which was completely, not completely, but mostly unconstrained, mostly unfettered. We want to find a happy medium where there is some constraint and some discipline, but as well as some fluidity, some elasticity, and some dynamicism, because we live in a dynamic world. We need to be able to roll with the punches. We need to be able to change with innovation, which is one thing the Eurodollar system did very, very well. It went right along with the telecom revolution. In fact, those two things were part and parcel with one another. So we want a monetary system that can be dynamic. And I don't, you know, a truly fixed monetary system is just not going to be.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for being on the podcast again. Any closing thoughts? I thought this just went very well. So any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
Closing thoughts, I mean, I think we need to take odds or bet on how long Jay Powell and FOMC can keep hiking rates as things start to go more and more wrong. Because, you know, as tragic as it all is, it's some ways it's actually comedy. It's entertainment because you know, like the 2008 example is extreme. You know, one extreme example of how absurd it can get, where the central bank's doing one thing in the monetary system and the world economy is doing the complete opposite. And the two didn't seem to meet at any place until it just became really bad. So how long can the Fed continue to hike rates and pretend inflation's our biggest threat when, you know, it looks like I mean, the markets are pretty confident that's not the case.
That's very true. And so on that note, thank you so much for being on the podcast, Jeff.
Well, thanks for having me, Sri. It's always good to talk.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.